I am the Martian ambassador. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace.
You know, that's just like your opinion, man.
It's time for Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gillen, I'm your host, and with me as always are my co-hosts, Robin.
Drop your linen and start your grinning.
And TK.
Battle is the great redeemer. It is the fiery crucible in which true heroes are forged.
It's always sad when a celebrity we like passes away, but it's especially sad when they die suddenly without warning, and I'm afraid that's what has happened recently, as Bill Paxton passed away on February 25th, 2017, due to complications from surgery. And man, this one really hurt. Nobody, of course, nobody saw it coming. Paxton was only 61 when he died, and he had amassed nearly 100 credits in film and television, including some truly iconic performances. So on this show, we'll be paying tribute to the late Bill Paxton as we count down our top three favorite Paxton roles and discuss his career right after this. The Back Row is dedicated to delivering free entertainment to everyone in the forms of media culture blogging, movie reviews, short films, podcasts, and more. That's awesome, I hear you say, and you're right, it is pretty awesome. So why don't you help us out by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes and leaving a review? Just search the iTunes store for Shouts from the Back Row to subscribe to our feed, and if you're feeling generous, visit the-back-row.com and click the donate button to send us some money. Your support means the world to us. We like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, and just about everything else we've been doing. So, TK, what have you been up to?
The only thing I've had a chance to get into is I did catch Logan this weekend, and I know that we're going to save this topic for an upcoming podcast, but I just wanted to give my very brief thoughts on it. This is a really really good X-Men movie. I think it's probably I haven't compared it all the way to the other ones yet, but it's definitely in my top for sure. Hugh Jackman knocks it out of the park, so does Patrick Stewart, and it's just all around it's just an excellent film. I don't want to say anything else about it, to be frank.
Gonna save most of our discussion on Logan for our next episode, which will be in 2 weeks. We're off next week, where we'll be discussing the entire X-Men franchise. But I also saw Logan, and I'll say the same thing. Unlike TK, I have made up my mind, and I think Logan is unequivocally the best X-Men movie, and just a great movie. I think what makes it the best X-Men movie is that you could watch it having seen all of the X-Men films and love it, and you could watch it just as its own thing and also really enjoy it. So I had a hell of a great time with Logan, and the one thing I will say, here's like a preview of stuff I'm going to say on our next episode, but the movie I would most closely compare Logan to is Terminator 2 Judgment Day. I think it is on par with that film, which is some big words there, I know. Robin, did you also see Logan?
Yes. I would say it's definitely the best X-Men movie overall. It's not just a good X-Men movie. It's not just a good superhero movie. It's a great movie altogether. And it's such a breath of fresh air, I think, because we've talked before about how we've been so oversaturated with superhero movies that the genre is starting to feel stale. But this one just knocks it out of the park because it takes it in such different places because it is an R-rated movie that deserves its R rating. And I couldn't think of a better character to put in this type of story than Logan, because he is pretty much a miserable character, and it just seems so, he seems so at home in like an R-rated movie where he's shouting F-bombs at kids a lot and just like killing people with his claws. Like, this is a very violent, very profane movie that shocks and surprises at many times, but it's just so great to watch, and it's just like such a fresh take on the genre. And the only complaint I have about it is that I really think that all the superhero movies that come out through the rest of the 2017 are really going to pale in comparison. They're probably going to seem pretty generic compared to this one, because this one goes in places that the genre has not gone before. So big thumbs up from it. It's the best superhero movie I've seen, I think, in years.
I mean, they might as well just pack in the X-Men franchise now. I don't think they're going to top Logan. Been up to anything else, TK?
I'm afraid not. What have you guys been doing?
Yeah, Robin, what else have you been up to?
Well, other than Logan, I want to briefly talk about a movie that I'm ashamed to say I actually watched, but it popped up on Netflix this week, and I just had to see this out of morbid curiosity. It's the movie Nine Lives, starring Kevin Spacey as the voice of a cat. And if you haven't heard of this one, the story is that Kevin Spacey plays a typical Kevin Spacey character, like a ruthless businessman who's an asshole most of the time and neglects his family. But then he has an accident where he falls off a building and is left in a coma. And Christopher Walken plays the owner of a wacky pet store who reincarnates Spacey's soul inside a cat. And of course, he can't change back until he learns some valuable life lessons and stuff. So, I mean, you think with these two actors that even if it was a terrible movie, it would be an entertaining bad movie. But it's sadly just a generic family movie. Like, Spacey and Walken just look bored. Like, I don't think I've ever seen a Christopher Rock Walken role where he just seems bored out of his mind. Like, he always puts his distinct touch on it, but you can tell he really, really doesn't want to be here. Like, and it's the kind of movie all it has is a bunch of stupid cat puns. Like, there's a joke where Kevin Spacey says, oh, I think I need to get an MRI. Well, how about a cat scan? Da-da-da, and stuff. Just brutal, and then he learns a valuable life lesson, yada, yada, yada. But even though the movie, it's so generic that it's not worth watching, but the story behind it is just very, very interesting how this got made, because while I was watching it, I saw that it had 5 screenwriters credited it, and I'm like, how does a movie like this get 5 writers? Well, apparently this was an idea originally pitched by like this French owner of a studio who wanted to make an existential comedy about a guy who gets trapped inside a cat, but the cat wouldn't actually speak. Like, it would be from his point of view where he has to observe the world around him, but he doesn't actually speak about anything. So it sounded like kind of a quirky Charlie Kaufman-esque type of comedy, but apparently after they wrote an original draft of the script, this guy was forced out of his job, and the new head of the studio saw it and was like, what the hell is this? Why did we purchase this script? But then just decided, you know what? We can just make this into a family comedy about a guy who's in a cat's body, but the cat actually talks. And then apparently they got more writers to rewrite it and stuff. But what's hilarious is that there's a very interesting article online you can find about it titled How Nine Lives Saved My Life, because apparently one of the writers who was hired to work on it, he said that he needed this job so badly because his contract with the Writers Guild was about to run out in a couple weeks and he would lose his health insurance. And after he finished writing this, he got a brain tumor and had to get it operated on. But if he hadn't written such a shitty movie, he would have lost his health insurance. But because he had health insurance and wrote this script, he was able to get the surgery he needed to cure his brain tumor. So I guess it's a small price to pay. They made a terrible movie, but it saved the guy's life. So I guess that's a bright spot to it. But this is just a prime example of a movie where you're wondering, like, how does something like this get greenlit? But you can see what happens when you just get like a bunch of differing executives, a bunch of different writers, and they have completely different ideas about what to do about this movie. Though I have no idea how they got Kevin Spacey or Christopher Walken to agree to do this, because Spacey's still in House of Cards. He's still pretty successful. He can't be that desperate. And as I was watching it, the only thing I was thinking of was, what happens if House of Cards next season Frank Underwood becomes a cat as the president of the United States? That might actually be kind of intriguing, but the movie itself is not. So even as a curiosity piece, I wouldn't recommend watching this. Had you heard about this movie before I mentioned it?
I had definitely heard of it. I was working at a movie theater around the same time that it was released, I believe. I think right when I left my movie theater job last year, I think it was just coming out, like as I was transitioning out of that job. So I'm definitely aware of it, and I too noticed it on Netflix, but I had no desire to see it. It just seemed like the dumbest thing ever. But you've completely blown my mind with the backstory of this film. Like, that sounds like a joke from Arrested Development or something. Not just the like crazy thing about how this movie saved a dude with a brain tumor, but that it was going to be like a French existential art film about a guy trapped in a cat's body, and then a studio head's like, "We're just going to make a family picture. Christopher Walken is going to play a wacky pet store owner." Like, my God, that I want to see the making of this movie. I don't care about Nine Lives. I want to see the making of featurette on Nine Lives, because that is an unbelievable story.
It is, yeah. Like, I would really like, I could see, like, a movie based on, like, the making of this movie, because it just the whole premise of it kind of reminds me of the movie Adaptation, like something that Charlie Kaufman would experience, because it's so bizarre. And I do have to wonder if maybe Walken and Spacey signed on to it when they thought it was going to be an existential comedy, but then it got changed to a stupid family movie and they were like, oh my God, we're stuck with this and stuff. But pretty fascinating. But yeah, like I said, the making of it is so, so much more interesting than the movie.
This definitely seems like a case of read the Wikipedia article and don't watch the film.
Yes, exactly. I don't know if it's on Wikipedia, but do a Google search on how Nine Lives saved my life, because that's a very fascinating article. And as far as what else I've been up to, we released a new mini-sode this week of The Trail Went Cold, and this is our first seafaring mystery about a missing boat. It's an Australian story about a boat called the Patinella, which just vanished without a trace during a voyage in 1988 after some final cryptic radio messages. And it's a pretty exciting episode, and if you go to our website to listen to it, you'll get a special surprise, and you'll see why this is our most exciting episode yet. So be sure to check out our website and you'll be pleasantly surprised by what you see. And yeah, that's all I've been up to.
As far as what I've been up to, I've taken in a few movies since our last episode, and I'll start by talking about Monster Trucks. That's right. I watched
Monster Trucks. Oh, you saw it? Why would you do that?
out of sheer curiosity, I assure you. This was not because I had any real desire to see the film, and I freely admit I don't support piracy, but I pirated this movie, and I'm glad that I did, because it is just not good. What had me intrigued, I should say, I put this on because I wanted something on in the background while I worked on a different project, and I wanted it to be something that I could easily ignore if I chose to. Like, something that I would not get distracted by, but I could just have some noise going on in the background. Boy, did I pick the right one, because this movie just does not have a hell of a lot of traction behind it. So I put it on for background noise, and I did watch it, and I was mostly intrigued because it is infamously based on an idea that, like, a studio head's six-year-old son had. Like, this is an idea that a child came up with. And, I mean, pretty obvious, you know, monster trucks. It's a movie about trucks that have monsters in them that let the people who get in the trucks drive super fast and do cool stunts. Like, it is the movie equivalent of a kid with Matchbox, like, Hot Wheels cars going, and, you know, going off big jumps and things like that. But just because a kid came up with the idea doesn't mean it's bad. A pretty famous example from pop culture is the Axe Cop comic, which was, you know, invented by a six-year-old and then illustrated by, I can't remember how old the older brother is, but he's like in his 20s, I believe, and he's, you know, a really good illustrator. So the two of them concocted Axe Cop, and it's just like wacky and ridiculous, but brilliant and fresh and original, because, you know, kids aren't tethered to logic the way adults are, and they can just pull crazy ideas out of thin air, stuff that we would never think of. So Axe Cop is an utter delight. A kid coming up with the premise for a movie, on the surface it sounds pretty stupid, but, you know, there some good could come of that, in theory. what I was thinking while I was watching Monster Trucks is, this premise isn't actually terrible, but there's no excuse for the script feeling like it was written by a six-year-old. The dialogue is just dumb. Like, it's the most bland, generic dialogue. It's all cliches, there are no memorable lines. I couldn't even quote one to you, but I can guarantee that it's the kind of thing where, like, you know, they rev up the trucks for a big chase, and the main character says something like, "Let's do this." It's like that kind of cliche, you know? No real originality in anything said. I can't remember any of the characters' names, and that's not just because I was only half paying attention. Like, it is just the most pedestrian script. However, there is, like, one tiny, teeny glint of redeeming quality to this movie, and I am not going to go to bat for Monster Trucks. This movie's terrible, and really forgettable. Sadly, it's not even, like, bad in an entertaining way. But the one tiny little glimmer of redemption is while I was watching it, at certain points, I thought to myself, this movie would have been right at home in the 1980s. If this had come out in the 1980s and was directed by, like, Joe Dante, and it's totally a Joe Dante premise, this could actually have been sort of like a beloved nostalgic classic. And who knows, maybe years from now it will be for, you know, a generation of kids who saw it today. It's nowhere near as good as those 80s, like, family sci-fi adventure classics. Like, I was reminded a lot of, like, Explorers or Flight of the Navigator. You know, one of those almost E.T.-esque knockoffs where a kid befriends an alien creature and, like, you know, together they build, you know, the kid gets to drive a spaceship or, you know, they make some contraption out of junk or something like that. Because the premise of Monster Trucks is that these monster creatures that feed on, like, oil and gasoline, an oil drilling company led by the evil Rob Lowe, like, they drill into this cavern system where these monsters live, and they capture some of the monsters. One of the monsters escapes, befriends some, like, misfit son of a deadbeat mechanic, and they form, like, one, you know, a boy and his dog partnership. And then the kid discovers that if the monster gets under the hood of the truck, it can drive the truck for him and do cool stunts. Like, it really does have sort of this 80s premise to it. But sadly, terrible execution, a bad release, and an inexplicably huge budget kill this movie. It made it a huge... Like, this movie really should have been a mid-budget, like, family film. You know, you make it for, like, $50 million, $40 million, in that range, and maybe it'll recoup its costs. And you release it in summer as well. I don't know why this came out in January. I guess because it's a terrible movie. But somehow, Monster Trucks wound up with, like, a $150 million budget. It's just too much. I don't know. This got bungled, but maybe in an alternate dimension, it came out 30 years ago, and everybody loves it today. So, Monster Trucks, honestly, it's probably not going to make my worst of the year list, because it wasn't, like, frustratingly bad. It was just really poorly made.
Well, I was looking at the poster of it, and it really looks like an 80s poster, like a movie that would have been released during that time period. So much potential. It could have been like a nostalgic throwback, but like you said, $125 million, does it even look like that money is up on screen, or does it just kind of look like a mid-level budget movie?
It really looks like a mid-budget movie. Like, I guess all that money went towards the monsters, because they're the big CGI creations. But honestly, like, they're in a lot of the movie, but a lot of the movie also just has them inside the trucks, you know, so you don't really see them. And there are no big stars. Rob Lowe is literally the biggest star in the entire movie. So I don't know. Maybe what we're witnessing here is some kind of, like, tax loophole thing. Maybe we're dealing with a situation, like, from the producers, where some Hollywood executive figured out, okay, I make this totally overinflated budget movie, and then somehow when it flops, I get to pocket a whole bunch of that money. Like, most of it goes to the director's salary or something like that. Oh, yeah, and we'll get a premise. I don't know. Get your son to come up with a premise, Jim. Oh, yeah, all right. I'll just ask my son. Like, maybe that's what we're dealing with in Monster Trucks. I could totally see it, because the movie does... The budget is nowhere on the screen, man. They could have done this for way less.
So it was made by the guys from Mel Brooks, the producers, pretty much.
This is my theory. Yeah, I suspect so. But yeah, don't bother with monster trucks. Not worth it. I'm not surprised it flopped. And the other film that I saw was a really great one. John Wick Chapter 2. It was a highly enjoyable film. If you liked the first John Wick, then I will say you'll like John Wick Chapter 2. I think I liked it about as much as I liked the first one. I don't know. John Wick Chapter 2 actually has some ambitions. They clearly want to expand this world of assassins that was established in the first film. And the excuse to get John Wick just killing everybody is a pretty fun one, where he gets called upon by someone he owes a favor to do one last job, but then after he performs that favor, that his employer turns on him, and so he's got to just kill everybody anyway. It's a smart little setup, but ultimately this is just like more of what we liked in the first one. Just great gunplay, long take action scenes that aren't shot with shaky cam, awesome little cameos from the likes of people like Ian McShane, you know, they just pop up, have nice little cameos in them, some really memorable assassin characters. I don't know. I don't have a lot to say about John Wick Chapter 2, because I didn't have a lot to say about John Wick. These are just awesome little action movies. They kick a whole lot of ass. And as Robin noted when you were reviewing it, I think it was on our last episode, Robin, this one ends with, like, not a cliffhanger, but a very obvious setup for a third movie, and it seems like they're going to make it, and that's great. I want it. Give me one more of these. One more of these, please. So John Wick Chapter 2, I do give it a big recommendation.
Yes, I concur. They've gotten a lot of mileage from such a simple premise about, like, a guy wanting revenge for his car being stolen and his dog being killed, but they did it by just creating such an interesting world. And they drop little hints here, like Lawrence Fishburne's character. Like, he's not on screen a lot, but his whole setup just seems so intriguing that I want to learn more about him and his character in the next movie. So I'm actually looking forward to it, and thankfully this movie has been a big hit, and so I know they're probably going to make a third one and finally cap off the trilogy.
There's a montage in the middle of John Wick Chapter 2 where, I'll say mild spoilers for John Wick 2, a hit is put out on John Wick, and all these assassins answer the call, and then there's just like a montage of him fighting all these different assassins. I loved that. Oh, that was so entertaining.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, it was really well done. Just really well handled. So, yeah, another recommendation for this one. And guys, I have to say, January may have been dull, but so far February and March have delivered some fantastic movies. Between Get Out, Logan, and John Wick Chapter 2, I've been having a hell of a good time at the theater lately. Like, these are all not just good, but above average to great movies. Big thumbs
yes.
up. Like, way to go, 2017.
Yes, I have technically seen 4 movies released this year, Get Out, John Wick, Logan, and The Founder, and they've all been great. I know they've released some crappy ones, but I haven't gone to see them, but the ones I have seen have all been terrific.
I intend to go see Kong Skull Island this upcoming weekend, so we'll see if it breaks the streak. I've heard it's actually really good, but this is sort of a wild card one because it just looks so way out there. And then the last thing I want to mention that I've been up to, TK, I got a question for you, buddy.
What's up, buddy?
You like the BioShock franchise, right?
Indeed, I do, very much. They are one of my favorite video games.
Have you played all 3 of the games?
Yes, I have.
So, I had never played BioShock 2. I had played BioShock, BioShock Infinite, and then in the Steam Winter Sale, I bought the full set of BioShock games, all 3 of them. And so I've started playing BioShock 2. And before I say what I think of it, so far anyway, I'd love to know what you think.
How far into the game are you?
I mean, I don't really know, but let's see. I just helped a dude get on a train. I thawed out a big door. He got on the train at Sinclair, I believe.
Okay, I enjoyed BioShock 2 because I felt that it was just like it was a natural progression for the. It was more of the first game, which is what I really wanted. I didn't like the personification as much, but like, I think the first like 15 minutes are really atmospheric. And I think that it continues that way as you explore these new parts of Rapture that you're being exposed to. I wasn't a huge fan of the ending of the film. Out of the three BioShocks, it's my least favorite, but with that said, it's still a BioShock game. And so it's leaps and bounds above a bunch of other like semi RPG shooters like it. Like, I love the game. Like, it's probably a 75% out of it for me, whereas the first one's probably an 85, and Infinite's probably about 90. Like, I really like this series. It weirdly resonates with me, and, like, no matter whether the game is good or not, it's still fun for me atmosphere-wise, so.
I mean, the BioShock games are all pretty terrific. The first BioShock is, I mean, they're all sort of like Jules Verne. That's how I describe them. They're not quite steampunk. They're just very Jules Verne. The first one is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. The last one is like Around the World in 80 Days almost, with the city in the sky. But your opinion is definitely one I've heard echoed in many different places, that BioShock 2 is the weakest of the three. And so far, I got to agree, because, as you said, it is more of the same. It's the same setting as the first BioShock game. Even if you're going to different areas of the same city, the atmosphere is practically identical. And so it's fun. Like, I'm going to finish this game, and it's really enjoyable. But I do kind of wish, like, I want to say regret, but I didn't create these games, so I don't know if I regret it. Like, I regret that they didn't go somewhere else with Part 2. I kind of wish that each of the three BioShock games had its own distinct city in a different, you know, a different environment, be it up in the sky or, like, deep underground. An underground mining city could have been really neat for Part 2. But, so, I don't know. If you really, really liked BioShock 1 and you want a game that kind of feels like an expansion, like almost more like an extended DLC than its own game, BioShock 2 is good. And as TK noted, still a really good game, but it doesn't feel as original as Part 1 and Part 3 of the series.
Like, the story extension is really interesting, but it is just essentially an extension of the first game, which, again, is perfectly fine. But, I don't know. It's just, I enjoyed playing through with it.
And that is all I've been up to. So now it's time for the Batshit Crazy Movie Countdown segment, where we count down the days until the release of movies that we think might be the craziest of any given year. And, sadly, I don't actually have a countdown to deliver, because none of the films that we think might be the craziest of this year have release dates yet, unfortunately. But the only one that we know anything about is the movie Bright, where it's like a buddy cop film with Will Smith, and Joel Edgerton plays his partner, who is an orc, in this sort of Shadowrun world of magic and medieval fantasy, but it's also like End of Watch, or like a police detective procedural. That's coming out in December, but I don't know the date. The reason I bring all of this up, though, is I just wanted to mention that the trailer for a movie called Geostorm has landed online, and I don't think it's going to be the most batshit crazy movie of the year, but it's going to be crazy, that's for sure. If you're not familiar, this is a movie where Gerard Butler goes into space to stop a terrorist who has hijacked weather-controlling satellites in a bid to assassinate the president, played by Andy Garcia. And it looks like Ed Harris will be reprising a similar role to the one he had in The Rock, where he's like a leader of a terrorist group, and in this case they want to take over a weather satellite. All of this is being headed by Dean Devlin, who was one of the writers on Independence Day, and frequently worked with Roland Emmerich. And the trailer is what you would expect from this kind of insane movie. I don't know if it's going to be any good, but I don't know, Robin, I think of the three of us, you're the biggest, like, Roland Emmerich fan, and so, like, maybe a Dean Devlin fan by association. Did you see the trailer for Geostorm? What do you think of this movie?
Not yet. I haven't seen the trailer for it. But I always watch Roland Emmerich, just no matter how absurd they are, because no matter how bad, he generally, most of the time, finds a way to get it make it entertaining.
Well, this does look like it will have that same level of entertainment. Like, it certainly weather-destroying cities, you know, that sort of thing. It's definitely there in Geostorm, but man, I don't know. I just don't know what to expect with this one. It's been on the shelf for years, apparently. So, man, I wonder, it could just be utterly atrocious.
Well, it seemed like it was a natural, like, step up from Olympus Has Fallen, London Has Fallen, and now they've gone into outer space. Like, why don't they just make it a trilogy of some sort? Because those movies get progressively more ridiculous. You have Gerard Butler, so...
Call it The Sky Is Falling.
Exactly! So natural.
Did you... Okay, this is just a tangent, but I moderate a subreddit dedicated to bad movies. And there was recently a discussion going on about London Has Fallen. I haven't seen it. Robin, did you see London Has Fallen?
Yes. Okay,
you go ahead.
Well, the thing I find hilarious about this movie is that, like, in the first movie, like, he was able to protect the president, but they pretty much, the terrorists, wiped out the entire Secret Service, most of, like, the White House staff. So you think that, like, that the government is going to be in complete chaos by the time, like, the sequel comes around. And then they go to London, and even though the president does get saved in this, the terrorists manage to wipe out, like, the leaders of, like, a dozen other countries. Like, I think they killed the Prime Minister of Canada, like, the Prime Minister of Japan, the President of France. Like, you think that, like, even though the one president survives, that the world is just going to be in utter chaos, like, after it's over? I just find it hilarious that they focus so much on Aaron Eckhart and Gerard Butler that they seem completely oblivious to the fact that these terrorists managed to, like, take out, like, so many people and stuff, and it's just, like, the world is just not going to function properly if a terrorist event like this actually happened. Like, I find it hilarious just how blasé they are about, like, the hundreds of thousands of innocent people that are killed in these movies.
It's 'cause America is the only country that matters.
Exactly, so, yeah.
So is it true that... Right, like when Gerard Butler kills the antagonist in London Has Fallen, right before he shoots him, he says, "Go back to Fuckheadistan."
Yes, he does.
Oh, God.
That almost made the whole movie sitting through just for that.
Oh my God, I can't believe. I thought a commenter on Reddit was like making fun of me or something. I didn't think it was real. Go back to Fuckheadistan. Jesus. Clearly we need to do an episode on Gerard Butler movies, so I have an excuse to watch this trash.
I'm very in for doing that, but
yes,
I will not
all right.
But I will not watch a bunch of these movies as a heads up.
All right, it's off.
Can my number 1 through 3 be Rock and Rolla? Is that a thing I can do?
What, you know, not a fan of 300? We're getting ahead of ourselves. We will revisit this topic on a future episode because, my God, that's too good. Oh, my God.
I just wanted to mention one other thing on a tangent for our batshit crazy movie countdown. This movie apparently already came out last week in a limited release. And have you heard of a movie called The Assignment?
You know, I've seen the poster for it, but that is all. It's with Michelle Rodriguez and Sigourney Weaver. Is that the one?
Yes, and I read the summary for it, and it is unbelievable. Sigourney Weaver plays a doctor who finds a contract killer who's played by Michelle Rodriguez as both a man and a woman. Like, she starts off the movie as a man, and she actually has a beard in it. And Sigourney Weaver's character, as punishment, decides to perform an experiment on her and give her, like, gender reassessment surgery and give her a sex change and turn her into a woman. But Michelle Rodriguez's character gets very angry about it and busts loose and starts killing people. And apparently what? The transgender community is pissed at this movie by, like, portraying Sigourney Weaver as a villain who forcibly gives an evil person transgender surgery as punishment.
Oh my God! Wait, the assignment refers to gender reassignment?
Exactly, yes. And I read that Michelle Rodriguez plays the character as a man at the beginning with a beard and then turns into Michelle Rodriguez after the surgery.
Oh my God. That's
And it's directed by Walter Hill.
What? Oh my god. I had no idea.
Oh, I read a summary on this on a website, and I said this has to be a batshit crazy countdown, but then I found out it came out on March the 3rd.
I mean, I guess I have to watch it, but that sounds... This is terrible. Who thought that was a good idea? Just give her a beard? Like,
yeah.
Oh my god. Wow. Well, this has been one of my favorite batshit crazy movie countdown segments in a while, I have to say. Excellent, man. Next time we record, I fully intend to have a report on the assignment, because, oh my god, that just sounds insane. On that note, we move on to a slightly more somber affair, but you know, for all that it is very sad that Bill Paxton has passed away, I don't think our discussion is actually going to be all that somber, because, man, he was just such a fun actor. I mean, obviously he gave his fair share of serious, dramatic, and indeed scary roles, but so many of the roles that he is known for are just high energy, highly quotable, fun characters. And, is it safe to say, guys, that we were all fans of Bill Paxton?
Oh, definitely. Like, well, going over, like, his filmography, I was like, there are just so many good roles to choose from. How can I choose my top three?
And TK, you were a fan, of course.
Yeah, I'm a big Paxton fan. Whether it's his television work or his film roles, he's always a delight to have show up on screen.
And he really was this almost omnipresent character. I wish I could remember who said it and the exact quote, but one of the some celebrity, it may have been James Cameron, who worked with Bill Paxton quite a bit, said something along the lines of, he made everything he was in good. He was always good, and he made the movie good for being in it. And I absolutely agree. After I read the news that Paxton had passed away, I almost, kicked myself. Like, I almost beat myself up a bit for not appreciating him enough, just because he so frequently played supporting roles. He played starring roles as well, but mostly he was like this secondary player, and he was just always great. Like, he was one of the all-time great supporting character actors. Like, I was floored, like you, Robin, going through his filmography and just going, like, my god, all these great movies, and he just contributed so much to every one of them. So the question I always like to start these discussions about actors with is, when did you first become aware of Bill Paxton? TK, do you remember the first time you took note of Bill Paxton?
Yeah, it's like I've described on this podcast before, my mom went through this period where she would just rent movie series for my brother and I to watch. And so I think the first thing I was really exposed to him, it was Aliens. My god, is he a character in Aliens? It is fantastic. And that leaves such an image, right? Because he has some of the most quotable lines, I think, of the film. And from there on in, you just start to see him pop up everywhere. Like, you'd watch Terminator and go, oh, hey, it's him, and just and keep going from there. But no, he was everywhere.
Robin, what was the first thing you remember seeing Bill Paxton in?
It's strange, because I got introduced to James Cameron movies, all during the same time period, so I think I saw some of his roles, all within, the span of, a couple weeks or a month. And I don't remember the exact first thing I saw him in, but I think it was True Lies that I first took note of him, and then I realized, oh yeah, that guy had a small role in The Terminator, and I think it was only a couple weeks after I saw True Lies that I saw Aliens for the first time, and then he really stood out to me, and then I kind of remembered him because he was kind of a that guy where it's like I'd probably seen him in supporting roles or small roles in a couple of films, but he didn't really register for me. But I think it was during that phase when I got introduced to James Cameron's films that he suddenly became memorable.
And you know, I had a very similar experience as well. I think that I saw True Lies before I saw Aliens. I believe I saw it. Well, I know that I saw True Lies when it was first released. And that might surprise some people. If anybody keeps track of my age, you'll know that I was only 11 years old when True Lies came out, and that's a rated R movie. I saw it at a drive-in movie theater for, like, one of my friend's birthday parties. He had, like, the cool dad who didn't care if the kids watched rated R movies, so we all went and saw True Lies at a drive-in. And I mean, I'm sure Paxton's role in True Lies will come up again, but yeah, shortly thereafter, I watched Aliens, and later that same, like, only a few years later, still was Titanic. So it's sort of like the 90s and James Cameron movies combined to introduce a whole bunch of people to Bill Paxton's work. Certainly all three of us. It's either James Cameron or 90s James Cameron or both that brought Bill Paxton into our range of attention. So, I mean, let's not hesitate any further. Let's talk about Bill Paxton roles, because I know we all have a lot to say, and certainly as we reach my number one, it might come up sooner on one of your guys' lists, but I want to do some Bill Paxton quotes, and I don't want to, like, tip my hand totally yet. So let's talk about our top three favorite Bill Paxton roles, performances, characters, movies, TV shows, and we'll start with you, TK. What is your number three?
My number three isn't a big role, but it's I get a kick out of him every time I saw it. I first watched Edge of Tomorrow, I think, 2 years, two years too late after it had come out, because it seemed sort of middling, but I kept hearing all these people, I should go see it. And, like, in addition to the cool time skipping, and, like, Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt did a really good job, Bill Paxton plays this master sergeant who wakes Tom Cruise up at the beginning of every time scene with, "Get up, maggot!" And just, like, we don't learn a lot about him, and he just, his job is to lead Tom into this hangar where he meets a bunch of people, and then, like, that's pretty much it, and then leads him into battle. And, like, that's pretty much the last of it. But he's so captivating, and he has this exaggerated southern U.S. accent, and it's just, he's such a treat to watch, and, like, every little bit and quip, like, Cruise tries to escape push-up duty by rolling under a car, and he gets run over a few times while trying to do it. And Paxton, like, look of disgust on his face every time he sees it is just priceless to me. But just, I started the show with my favorite quote from him, where he talks about being reborn in the fires of battle, and it's rousing. I get a big kick out of this guy. He's great.
So, Edge of Tomorrow, I mean, It was a really underrated movie for a long time, and I think a lot of that probably had to do with just a really poor rollout of it, because is it called Edge of Tomorrow, or is it called Live, Die, Repeat? Or is Live, Die, Repeat the tagline? It's like the studio never even really decided what the movie is called. But yeah, Edge of Tomorrow is a great, fun sci-fi action film, highly enjoyable in unexpected ways, and Bill Paxton is terrific in it. Robin, Edge of Tomorrow, what do you think of the movie and Paxton's part in it?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the movie as well. It's one of those movies that didn't do as well as expected at the box office, but everyone I know who's seen it really likes it a lot, and it is pretty underrated. But it is an ideal role for Paxton, because, like, they're kind of playing off his Aliens persona by having him be the master sergeant. Like, he's kind of playing the role of Sergeant Apone from Alien, the guy who was always chewing out Hudson, only this time he's chewing out Tom Cruise. And what's great about it is that because of the, like, time loop and the repeat, you get to see him act out the same scenes over and over again. So you get to see him chew out and get angry with Tom Cruise, like, dozens of times, which is pretty fun to see. So I think that was really ideal casting, to take the guy who's familiar with another military movie and put him in the role of, like, the master sergeant, and he's a ton of fun in the role.
Yeah, I mean, he has these very memorable little bursts, like chewing people out, and, you know, those trademark lines like "Get up, maggot." But like you said, it's sort of a neat showcase for Paxton's talents, because mostly he's just doing this one scene, but he's doing it over and over, and so you get to see how much he maintains, like, tries to do it exactly the same, and then every now and again you'll get some just slight variation. And in a way, like, it's the kind of thing where on the surface you might think, oh, that's a really boring role for an actor, because he just does the same thing over and over. But I kind of feel like Bill Paxton might have approached it like, you know, this is an opportunity to just do these little variations, you know, turn it up a notch here, turn it down a notch there. And somehow, even though we're only getting these same sequence of events over and over with this character, you do feel like you get a sense of his personality, and you know a bit more about him, even just seeing the same thing. Something that occurred to me when I was thinking of Edge of Tomorrow, and it's in my honorable mentions, was I was thinking back on Hacksaw Ridge, because there's the whole sequence in the middle of Hacksaw Ridge where it's boot camp, and Vince Vaughn is the drill sergeant chewing out the troops. And I personally did not really think Vince Vaughn was especially intimidating or convincing in that role. And when I think of Bill Paxton in Edge of Tomorrow, it's like there's something that he brings. Like he has this kind of gruff authenticity that Vince Vaughn didn't have. And I do wonder if it's because of what you said, Robin, how he was on the other side. He played a character on the other side of that in Aliens. He got to play like the sniveling wise ass in Aliens getting chewed out by the drill sergeant. And so when it's time for Paxton to play a drill sergeant, you know, he gets to chew out the sniveling wise asses. Robin, what's your number three?
Well, my number three is the one that I just talked about, True Lies, because this was the first role I saw Paxton in, which left a memorable impression and shows just how funny he could really be. Because when you look at the structure of True Lies, it is kind of bizarre, because like the first and third act are like mostly like action oriented about Arnold Schwarzenegger trying to stop terrorists. But the entire midsection just switches to a completely different subplot where he thinks his wife is cheating on him by this guy played by a guy named Simon played by Bill Paxton. And Arnold is wondering, like, is he a spy? Is he doing it to get to me? And then he finds out that the guy is just like a sleazy used car salesman who pretends to be a spy to women because that's the only way he can get laid. And then you revealed about what a loser and what a sleazebag he is. But it's just, it's the transition is just so weird that if this was cast with the wrong actor, then the movie would probably just bog down in the subplot that you'd kind of be wondering, okay, let's just get back to the action. Let's stay away from this. But Paxton is so hilarious that this whole second act with him is very entertaining. Like the whole section where Arnold meets him for the first time is just one of the funniest passages in the movie, and this is where Paxton gets some of his best lines, like the vet gets them wet and husbands, they're dickless, because if they took care of business, if they could take care of business, then I'd be in business, blah 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 blah. And just the way that Arnold is just like controlling, trying to bristle down this rage and stuff that he really, like, he's fantasizing about punching him out and stuff. And just the way that they finally give him his comeuppance by like pretending to kidnap him and stuff, and then Simon winds up like wetting himself and stuff, and Paxton is just like crying. It's just so hilarious. And he pretty much steals the movie in all the scenes he's in, but like this is the first movie I really saw him in that really made an impression. And then afterwards I saw him in Aliens and so many other things and stuff, but it's just a tailor-made role for him, and he pretty much steals the movie.
So I didn't know what to do with True Lies as far as putting it in my ranking, because I enjoy the movie and especially Bill Paxton in it more than it should, you know, then should be the case for something in my honorable mentions. But I didn't want to put it in my top three because it's kind of a janky film, as you put it, Robin. It's a weird structure. So I just sort of noted down, True Lies is on my list, piggyback on someone else. So True Lies, it's sort of like unofficially, I guess, is my number four. And it is a really fun action movie, and it's a good roles for Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee Curtis. But as you said, Bill Paxton steals the movie, because his scenes in the middle with that whole plot dalliance about Schwarzenegger's romantic life, those scenes are so funny. Standing on the edge of, it's like a dam or a bridge, and he's saying, you know, like, I got a little dick, it's pathetic, I gotta lie to women to get laid, and I don't even score that much. Would a spy piss himself? It is brilliant seeing him crumble into this sniveling, weeping pile of nothingness. And Paxton plays the character as a sleazeball super well, too. Like, he's just so greasy and just like the lowest of the low, you know? Such a, like, lizard, reptilian kind of scumbag character. It's fantastic. I love True Lies. I just didn't know where to put it. TK, is True Lies on your list?
It's sadly not on my list, but because I was for sure it was going to show up on one of yours. Yeah. But I love the fantasy Arnold has when he punches him and breaks his nose in the vet. It's fantastic.
So my number three, this is kind of an interesting one. I decided with my number three, I could have gone for True Lies, and there are a bunch of other films in my honorable mentions that just got edged out, but I wanted to bring some attention to a kind of like a lesser known, forgotten Bill Paxton performance in a fairly decent movie, and also one that has some weird kind of 6 degrees of separation connections to this very podcast. The film is called The Last Supper. Robin, TK, have you guys heard of this movie? It's from 1996.
I remember when it came out, but I never actually saw it.
Can't say I have.
So, I'll start with just like the plot. I'll start with a plot description, and then I'll get more into Paxton's part in a bit. This is a movie. It stars a really young Cameron Diaz, and Ron Eldard is also in it. Annabeth Gish, Ron Perlman, and of course Bill Paxton. And it's about this group of they're mid to late 90s liberals, I guess you could call them. They're all like students who live together in, you know, this rundown house, and they have these highly liberal values. They're sort of social justice warriors, and the movie kicks off when this guy named Zach, played by Bill Paxton, he helps move the broken down car of one of these characters, one of these students who all live together. And they, to thank him, they invite him back to their place for dinner. And at dinner, Paxton reveals himself to be a Desert Storm vet and a Holocaust denier and a neo-Nazi. And he just starts spewing all this, you know, racist vitriol and like threatening the students. He pulls out a knife and he threatens to actually rape one of the women, and in response, they kill him. And so all of these students, now in it together, decide that they're going to cover up the murder, and that in a way, they've made the world a better place by removing this guy from it. So then they start inviting all of these evil, conservative, homophobic, misogynistic, like, you know, these crooks, these climate change deniers, anti-Semitic people, they invite them all to dinners and kill them and poison them and hide the bodies. And they start believing, you know, they are making the world a better place. And all of it comes to a head when they invite a character played by Ron Perlman, who's sort of like a Bill O'Reilly style character. He's this like conservative pundit on TV. They invite him to dinner, and that's sort of like the head of the movie. But so it's this really cool kind of thriller. It reminds me of a movie like Shallow Grave, the Danny Boyle film. And it's a great part for Bill Paxton because, you know, we've said Paxton could do comedy. He can be gruff. He can be sniveling. He can be sleazy. But here is a part where he is genuinely scary. He's like a frightening neo-Nazi who's ready to kill some of the main characters. And he's absolutely terrifying. It's a really good showcase. It's a small role, but it's just a great showcase for more of Paxton's range. Man, he could just do anything. So, The Last Supper gets a big recommendation, and then here's the weird connection to this podcast. I can't remember if I actually mentioned it on the show, but I know I told you guys that I took part in an AMA on Reddit with the director of The Bye Bye Man. That would be one Stacy Title. And, you know, we had a brief little interaction. So I actually, you know, we made fun of, oh, bye-bye, the bye-bye man. I interacted with the director. And Stacy Title is also the director of The Last Supper.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
I had no idea.
To bring it right back around. So there you go. Check out The Last Supper, this sort of forgotten thriller. And it's, you know, it's got like a 6.8 out of 10 on IMDb. It's not poorly rated. And sadly, I think too few people know about it. I remember that I got a VHS copy of it sometime in the 90s from like a yard sale. And it was actually a pretty good movie. And also interesting to see a very young Cameron Diaz right at the beginning of her career. TK, what is your number two?
My number two is Twister. I couldn't keep it off the list. I rewatched it the other day just to catch up with this. So I just forgot how much fun it is. And his back and forth with Helen Hunt is really good. And his I don't know. He just no one else could have starred in that film, I feel, and kind of brought the same energy to it. I enjoy watching it. Like, it's not the greatest film, but it is a really good Bill Paxton film.
You said you watched this recently?
Yeah, I did. A few days ago, I think.
How do the special effects hold up?
Ooh, not great. Not
That's what great I was well. Wondering about when I was thinking about it recently. Not very good. That movie is doubly sad now because it's Bill Paxton and Philip Seymour Hoffman. And although the movie itself is pretty ridiculous, as I recall, it's been a long time since I watched it, it's still really good fun, and I'm not too proud to admit that I loved it when I was like 15 years old. Robin, what do you think of Twister?
Well, Twister's a fun movie, but I wouldn't say it's one of Bill Paxton's best performances. I've always thought he's kind of wooden in this one, but I can't really blame him because some of the dialogue he is given is so bad. Like, I remember the introduction he gives to Cary Elwes's character, and he has the line delivery that he went out and got corporate sponsors. He's in it for the money, not the science. And it just sounds so bad. But
the evil, like, meteorologist cracks me up.
And they all have, like, black Humvees and stuff just to show how evil they are. Like, it's pretty corny, but, and, like, the writing from it is pretty bad. But it's still pretty fun just to see them outrun tornadoes, and there's some fun interactions between, like, the characters. Like, Philip Seymour Hoffman's a lot of fun in the supporting role, but I wouldn't rank this among the best Bill Paxton performances just because I always thought that the bickering with him and Helen Hunt and the other fiancé played by Jimmy Gertz was, like, really, really annoying, so. He didn't exactly have the best material to work with.
Oh, but he's the extreme, man. He's the extreme.
Very 90s, obviously.
Oh, man, yeah. It was Yann DuBont, right, who directed Twister?
Yes.
Do you know if it was his follow-up to Speed?
Yes, it was, yes. And what's funny is it also has Alan Ruck in it. He used him in Speed and Twister, which I thought is hilarious.
You know, this is one I may have to revisit just to see how bad it's gotten. Cause I remember loving it when I was 14 or 15 years old, whenever it came out. Like, I remember my girlfriend at the time, it was her favorite movie. I watched the hell out of Twister. And, for the longest time, until I moved, when I moved, I got rid of a whole bunch of my movies. And for the longest time, I had a Twister VHS tape and it went with that movie purge. So, even though, like, it's not on my list, it's in my honorable mentions, and I agree, it's not one of the best, it's just not a great movie, but it is still a fun movie. I'll happily acknowledge that much. Robin, what's your number two?
My number two is a very underrated horror film in which Bill Paxton gets to play a psycho, and that's Frailty, which I've always been championing since it came out in around 2002. And what's great about this one is that Paxton, like, he starts off the movie being your typical likable Bill Paxton character. Like, he's a father raising two boys who loves his sons, is hardworking, very religious, and he seems normal. But then all of a sudden, he tells his sons that I've got a message from God. We have to kill some demons. And then he brings his sons along, and he starts killing random people with an axe that he is convinced have been possessed by demons sent by Satan and stuff. And what's great about the movie is they leave it completely ambiguous about whether or not he's completely insane or if he's if he really is on a mission from God and is really doing good deeds. And what is so terrifying about his character is that he genuinely believes he's right. Like, even though he is brutally murdering people, like, he genuinely believes that God is telling him to do this because he is not an evil person by heart. He just is doing what he thinks is right. But as the movie goes along, like, his sons do not want to go along with this, so he's forced to do stuff like lock his son in a cellar until he agrees to kill people and then put an axe in his son's hands and get him to, like, butcher people and stuff. It's pretty terrifying. Just a weird cross between like a likable Bill Paxton, but a psychotic Bill Paxton. And that's what's great about it is that you feel kind of bad for his character because like you just don't know what his motivations are. But it's a really well constructed thriller. It's also a great role for Matthew McConaughey, even though him and Paxton don't have any screen time together, and builds up to some pretty great twists at the end. And sadly, this movie is kind of forgotten, but when it came out, I thought it was one of the best horror movies I'd seen in a long time. And if you're a fan of Bill Paxton and want to see his great range as an actor, I definitely recommend you check out Frailty.
And one of the very few movies he's directed as well.
Oh yes, I'd forgotten he also directed it. Yes.
Yeah, I really like Frailty. It's another one that's in my honorable mentions. And, for all the reasons you outlined, like, it's a really good thriller. It's really scary. Great role for Bill Paxton. And it features that pre-McConaissance Matthew McConaughey. TK, have you seen Frailty?
No, it's one of the Paxton films I haven't had a chance to catch up
with.
I know I'd enjoy it. I'm just not there yet.
So, my number two should come as a surprise to no one. I never meant for this movie to keep popping up on the podcast. And, you know, I think because it keeps coming up, after this time, I might put it in my pantheon. I don't think it's already there, but it'll go there. So that I can avoid it a bit. But that's Tombstone. I've sung the praises of Tombstone on the podcast before. It's a great Kurt Russell role, great Val Kilmer role. I really like Sam Elliott in it. It's got, you know, Stephen Lang before Avatar, before he's, you know, has become as popular, before Don't Breathe. And Bill Paxton is one of the Earp brothers, Morgan Earp, who's sort of the romantic, eternal optimist. He's always like on the up and up. He's always ready to help his brothers. And spoilers for history, but his death of all of them feels like the most tragic, just because he was such a kind character. And it's the kind of like aw shucks role that could, in a way, it's very childish, I suppose. Like, it almost feels like it was written for someone a bit younger. But Bill Paxton really does a great job with it, and he maintains that, like, upbeat attitude. And you just, rather than him coming off as childish, he just comes off as kind of, well, optimistic and romantic, and maybe a bit naive. But yes, Tombstone. Morgan Earp is the role. Bill Paxton, I think he does a great job. Tombstone, guys, what do you think of it? And what do you think of Bill Paxton in it?
Well, you can't beat a trio of brothers that are played by Kurt Russell, Bill Paxton, and Sam Elliott. Now, that's a badass trio right there. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of Tombstone. I think it is a tad overrated, but of course he does a great job in it and stuff. I just kind of wish he had gotten his own no moment when he died, like Kurt Russell did in that movie.
Yeah, true. Tragically, he never has a chance to be a badass. He's always just like a genuinely good person. His character is almost like held up as the thing to fight for, like his optimism and his innocence, I want to say, is one of the reasons that the Earps wanted to, you know, lay down the law in Tombstone. TK, what do you think of Tombstone and Bill Paxton's part in it?
I haven't seen Tombstone for a number of years, but I do enjoy his character in it. Like Robin was saying, that's a pretty good three brother group to have going. But it's funny that as you mentioned it, I do understand what you mean about the role looked like it should have gone to someone younger, but Paxton still manages to pay it off really well. But now, from what I remember, it's a good spot for him.
TK, what is your number one Bill Paxton role?
So I'm taking a jump from film and into television, and I'm going to say that it's his role as Bill Henriksen from Big Love, which I watched in full a number of years ago and really, really enjoyed it. He plays a head of a Mormon polygamous family and has to keep him and his wives all kind of hidden from regular society as he tries to raise his kids and still fight with his family that still lives on the Mormon compound. But it's a really, really good role for him. We get this like serious side of him we don't usually see as much, and it's just a really good, well-rounded role for him. He's got really good co-stars that seem to bring out the best in him, and it's such an excellent television show. I don't know if you guys have a chance to watch even just a few episodes, but it's worth getting into.
I haven't watched it, but I vividly remember you talking about it on the podcast years ago as you were watching it. After I was done putting together my notes for this show, I actually had that thought, and I was like, wow, you know, Bill Paxton, he was there in the discussion right from the beginning. Really was this sort of omnipresent guy. Film, TV, he was all over the place, and we were always talking about him in one way or another. But I, alas, have not watched Big Love. I don't know, Robin, have you seen Big Love?
Never have. I was hoping to maybe see some episodes before this podcast, but I've heard so many great things about his role in it.
Robin, what is your number one?
Well, my number one is a Robin's underrated gem, which most people have not seen, but if you're a Bill Paxton fan, I think you definitely need to see this one. It's a movie called One False Move, which was made in 1992, and it also co-starred Billy Bob Thornton and was co-written by Billy Bob Thornton years before he got famous. This was a movie that was going to go like straight to cable, but then it was reviewed by Siskel and Ebert, who both called it like the best film of the year, and that caused them to get a theatrical release because of how good it was. It's kind of like a modern-day film noir, combination film noir western, where Paxton plays like the police chief of this very small town in Arkansas, who's a trio of criminals, one of them played by Billy Bob Thornton's character, are going to be gone on a murder spree in Los Angeles, and they think they're coming back to Arkansas because they have family members there. And Paxton's character, who is nicknamed Hurricane, is so excited because a bunch of cops from LA are going to come by and help him with the investigation, and he's just hoping that these three people are going to show up there and that he's going to get into a gun battle because he's like the chief of like this boring town, and now he's finally going to see some action. He plays like this hick good old boy, like a really likable, like very over enthusiastic guy, but then it turns out that one of the characters has a dark secret that's connected to him, and so he kind of goes into serious mode and stuff, and you find out the depth of this character and all the dark secrets he has, and it's Paxton's very first leading role, I think, because before this he was mostly like a character actor who did supporting roles, but this is the first time he played a lead, and he shows so much depth and range in this. Like he does like the comedy hilariously, and he also does the serious stuff very well. There's like one scene where he's in a restaurant, and the two LA cops are like poking fun of him for being such a hick, and they kind of focus on Paxton's face, and you can tell he looks so heartbroken that these two big city cops are poking fun of him, and you just feel so bad for the guy, and then builds up to like a really effective climax as well. I should mention that Billy Bob Thornton is also outstanding in this, because this is before he was well known, but he plays like a psychopath so well, and his script for this is really, really good, and it pretty much, I think, jump-started Bill Paxton's career a bit, because he started getting bigger roles in movies after this. He wasn't just a supporting guy, and even though the movie got a lot of acclaim at the time, it's kind of forgotten about today, but it's kind of a shame, because this was a big turning point in his career, and if you're a fan of Paxton's, I advise checking it out just to show how good of an actor he could really be.
Alas, this is one I've not seen. TK, have you seen it?
No, I can't say I have.
Really gotta watch it. You know, I gotta pick up again. I've slowly have been working my way through all of Robin's underrated gems.
Yes. Frailty is also a Robin's underrated gems as well, in case anyone hasn't seen that.
So my number one, I'm ready, man. Check it out. I am the ultimate badass. Stay to the badass art. You do not want to fuck with me. Check it out. Hey, Ripley, don't worry. Me and my squad of ultimate badasses will protect you. Check it out. Independently targeting particle beam phalanx. Whap. Fry half a city with this puppy. We got tactical smart missiles, phased plasma pulse rifles, RPGs. We got sonic, electronic, ball breakers. We got nukes. We got knives, sharp sticks. It's got to be Private Hudson from Aliens. I consider this character just one of the best characters in all of cinema. One of the most memorable because he just gets all the best lines. Paxton plays, you know, Private Hudson, who is the wimpiest, whiniest member of this team of ultimate badasses. And as you heard in that little monologue there, he starts off strutting around looking like he's a total pro, telling off Sergeant Appone and just, you know, cracking wise at every chance he gets. But man, when stuff starts going down, Hudson just, he becomes that same kind of True Lies character where he's just like whining and whinging and just, oh man, no, game over, man. Game over. What the fuck are we going to do now? Like, he just cannot shut up. And in the wrong hands, this role is Jar Jar Binks. This role is someone you hate. But boy, Bill Paxton just sinks his teeth right into it and made it his own. And for all that I love Ripley and Bishop and Hicks and the Alien Queen, there is nobody cooler in my mind than Private Hudson just because of Bill Paxton's amazing performance in the role. I could quote him all day long. Why do you put her in charge? He's so great. Guys, I mean, you knew it was coming. Aliens, Private Hudson. What do you think?
Yeah, that's the reason I didn't put him on my list, because I knew he was going to show up on yours. And pretty much he probably should be the number one for everybody, because this was the film that made Bill Paxton's career. And you're absolutely right that, like, if anybody else played this role, this would be, like, one of the most annoying characters of all time and would potentially kill the movie. But he does it so well that the character is strangely likable and endearing because of all of his whininess, and he has so many great lines. And I was glad that several years ago I finally got an opportunity to see Aliens on the big screen, and the audience just reacts to pretty much everything he does. Like, just laughs uproariously at all his lines, and even the small lines that you don't really notice, like, get huge laughs. Like, there's one moment where Ripley decides that, I think our best plan is to nuke this, go up into space and nuke the site from orbit, and then Hudson just says, fucking A! And that just made the audience laugh, just his, like, deadpan delivery of it, and just how enthusiastic he is to do that and stuff. So it just shows, like, how much he made the role his own, and it's definitely his best legacy in the role that everyone will remember him for.
TK, what do you think of Aliens?
Isn't it in the Pantheon?
Alien is in the Pantheon, but not Aliens.
Interesting. I love Aliens. Like, it's my favorite of the series, and the look of horror on his face when they start playing the knife game with his hand is, like, the funniest thing in the world to me. And just his like, slowly rising the screen. But like, he's a main memorable point of the film. It's amazing.
Hot as hell in here. Yeah, man, but it's a dry heat. It's just like, he's like the class clown of this team of ultimate badass Marines. My God, I just love, stop your grinning and drop your linen. He gets every good line.
Stop that shit, Hudson! Get your Apone yelling at him at all these lines.
So, those are our favorite Bill Paxton performances and roles, but I'm sure there are a lot more to talk about. TK, do you have any that we haven't mentioned yet you want to get out there?
He was really good in the miniseries The Hatfields and McCoys. He was excellent in it, actually, with starring opposite, Kevin, someone help me out here.
I haven't actually seen it.
No, someone help me out with the actor I'm thinking of. He was that shitty Robin Hood with the terrible accent. Thank you. Opposite Costner. He was really, really, like, I can't say enough. I actually really liked him in Nightcrawler as the opposing news group van leader. He was really good in that. trying to think of what else. He's great in Apollo 13. He's we've talked about a whole bunch of them, guys. I don't.
Well, here, let's flip it over to Robin.
Go for it.
Another great one is another movie he did with Billy Bob Thornton, Sam Raimi's A Simple Plan, which was Sam Raimi's first attempt to do a serious thriller, and he's excellent in that, playing like another ordinary guy who discovers a bunch of money and then becomes very, very greedy and starts killing people. It's another phenomenal dramatic performance from him in a very underrated movie. Also got to mention Near Dark, one of my favorite, probably my favorite vampire film of all time. He plays the role of Severn, the henchman, and it's another one of those characters like Hudson where he steals like every scene he's in by being just so obnoxious and getting like the best lines in every scene. The scene in the bar where he like slashes like a guy's throat with his spurs on his boot is just such classic Paxton, and I think it was his follow-up to Aliens, so they're a great 1-2 punch to watch together just because they helped jumpstart his career.
Near Dark is actually a really neat one because, I mean, Bill Paxton is amazing in it, as he's like the sadistic version of Hudson in that movie, like the same kind of like wise-ass attitude, but in this one he's just totally sadistic and this crazy evil vampire. But what's neat about Near Dark and Aliens is they really are companion pieces, because not only is Bill Paxton in both, but Lance Henriksen is in both, and Jeanette Goldstein, who plays Vasquez, is in both of them. And Near Dark was directed by Catherine Bigelow at the same time that I believe she was married or dating James Cameron, right around when they were making Aliens. So Near Dark and Aliens are both are great movies, great Bill Paxton roles, and they have a lot of neat connections like that.
Yeah, it's so cool just seeing all the characters from Aliens playing vampires in the same movie. It's a pretty cool 1-2 punch. I also want to mention his recent role in the movie Nightcrawler, where he played like the sleazy cameraman who goes to murder scenes and films them, and he plays kind of Jake Gyllenhaal's rival until Gyllenhaal gets him involved in an accident. Another great role at Bill Paxton playing a sleazeball. He was always good at that. He's good at playing nice characters and whiny characters, but he's also great at playing sleazeballs, and he's outstanding in that movie as well. Also want to mention his early role in the movie Weird Science, playing Chet, the douchebag older brother. It's before he was famous, but he plays the role pretty well. He, like I said, he's very good at playing douchebags as well. And also want to mention his role in the movie A Trespass with Walter Hill, back when he wasn't making movies about gender reassignment.
We're bringing it back around.
A callback to this one, but this is a really underrated movie that's actually co-written by Robert Zemeckis, where Bill Paxton and William Sadler play two guys who go searching for hidden gold inside the projects in a dilapidated building and run afoul of some gangsters played by Ice-T and Ice-Cube. It's a really solid action movie as well, very underrated, and highly recommend checking that out.
And I have even more that we haven't mentioned. I mean, this really speaks to how great and how prolific Bill Paxton was. But you got to mention that he was in Predator 2. It was not like a huge role or anything, but it helped him get the distinction of being one of the only people killed by an alien, a predator, and a Terminator. So there you go, completing the hat trick. Also, none of us said it. We've been talking about James Cameron, who owes a huge debt of gratitude to Bill Paxton. He's in Titanic. I mean, he's in Titanic. He's in one of the biggest movies of all time. His role is not the most memorable. You know, he's got a few sort of, like, profound sounding lines where, you know, every time she comes out of the darkness, I get chills, stuff like that. But mostly he just serves as someone to listen to expository dialogue.
And we didn't mention this on our Oscar telecast, but it was kind of an eerie coincidence because that was the same day that he died, and they had a commercial for Rolex during the Oscars where they showed a lot of scenes from classic movies of the characters wearing Rolexes, and they actually showed Bill Paxton in Titanic, who was wearing one while he was searching for it underwater. So it was pretty eerie to see that, like the day after he died, him popping up on TV like that.
I do want to say also about Titanic, to see some really funny Bill Paxton acting from Titanic, look up the deleted alternate ending where where old Rose is like confronted before she drops the jewel into the ocean, and the crew catches her, and then she drops it, and Bill Paxton just like, aha, he laughs and throws his hands in the air and dances about, while one of his friends goes, that really sucks, lady.
Kind of ruins the poignancy of the dramatic ending if they threw that in there.
Yeah, it is hilarious. I'm pretty sure it's on YouTube. You can definitely find the alternate ending to Titanic, and it's real. I think, at least the rumor is, that James Cameron shot it and intentionally made it terrible so that the studio wouldn't mess with the ending he intended. So, I don't know if that's true or not, but it is hilarious, and Bill Paxton is pretty fun, and he's clearly having fun with this stupid ending. I got a couple more to mention. It's not a major role, and he's just playing this fatherly role, but I really liked the movie Haywire, the Steven Soderbergh action film with Gina Carano, and it's a great action spy movie, and it has this amazingly star-studded cast, including the likes of Channing Tatum, Michael Fassbender, Michael Douglas, Antonio Banderas, Ewan McGregor, and Bill Paxton, of course, playing the father of the main character. So I think that Haywire is a sadly underrated action film. It seems like a lot of people have forgotten it, but it's great, and it's got Bill Paxton. You should watch it. And the last one I want to mention is a movie that's... Okay, this movie's not very good, but it's maybe better than people give it credit for, and that's Club Dread. Have any of you guys seen Club Dread?
I never have, no.
This was the follow-up to Super Troopers from the Broken Lizard guys, and it just got panned, it bombed really bad, it seemed like a lot of people hated it. But I have seen it, and you know what? It is not terrible. It is undeniably stupid, but, I mean, Super Troopers is a really funny comedy. Those guys, it's not like they lost all their talent when they made the next movie. In a way, it's almost ahead of its time, because it's vaguely sort of Shaun of the Dead-esque in how it sends... It's basically parodying something like I Know What You Did Last Summer, where an island resort is being terrorized by a slasher, and everybody's a suspect. And it's dumb, but there are actually a lot of really funny gags in it. There are a lot of really funny and memorable jokes. So, Bill Paxton plays the owner of the resort, and his character is called Coconut Pete, and he's this, like, has-been musician who was basically like Jimmy Buffett, and he had a few big hits in, like, the late 70s and maybe the 80s, and made a lot of money, and now he's just like a burnout has-been who parties all the time on his island resort. And he is really funny. His performance is just really terrific here. And throughout the whole thing, he's just like, he basically spends the whole movie hating on Jimmy Buffett. Somebody, he's playing guitar and somebody's like, hey, why don't you play Margaritaville? And he's like, Margaritaville? You mean the song that Jimmy Buffett ripped off of my hit, Pina Coladaberg? It's really stupid, but Paxton is great in it. And I don't know, if you're in the mood for a dumb comedy, Robin, you especially, as a fan of the horror genre, I'd love to know what you at least think of Club Dread, because I don't think it's as terrible as a lot of people have made it out to be. And like I said, great role for Bill Paxton. So I believe that brings us to the end of our discussion of Bill Paxton and our favorite Bill Paxton roles, performances, movies, television shows. Do you have any final thoughts on the man?
I just wanted to mention that he is also a part of one of the biggest events in American history. When he was 8 years old, he actually showed up to a hotel in Fort Worth, Texas, to see JFK give a speech on the morning he was assassinated. And someone snapped a photo of the crowd gathering, and Paxton was put on somebody's shoulders. So you can clearly see him above the crowd in a very famous photo when he's only 8 years old. He's the boy towering above the crowd. So not only did he have like an amazing career, but he was part of one of the most famous events in history. So what a life he led.
Yeah, my God. His death came as such a shock. It's so sad.
It's kind of odd. At the beginning of February, he did an interview with Mark Maron on his WTF podcast, which I listened to. But Maron does these episodes where he'll interview two people, like one after another, and they're shorter. And I don't usually like listening to them because I like to have a full hour and a half or so dedicated to one person. So I saw Bill Paxton paired with someone I didn't quite know, and I'm like, no, I won't pass. But I went back and downloaded it the other day, and I still have yet to listen to it. But apparently he talks about like how he got into acting and talks, and what's kind of eerie is he talks about how he had a damaged heart valve because he had a bunch of like rheumatoid fever when he was younger, and it's creepy to think of that now.
Yeah, I guess it was surgery on that heart valve that in the end killed him, which is such a shame. But boy, he left a great legacy. I'm going to be quoting Private Hudson like until the day I die. It really is. He's just one of my favorite movie characters to quote in particular. Game over, man. It's game over.
You heard it here first, folks. McGill's foot's dying words are going to be game over.
Game over, man. I mean, I'd be happy to go out on that. you'll be missed, Bill Paxton. You'll be missed. And now it's time to play the Ticket Price is Right box office prediction game, where we try to predict the opening weekend box office grosses of movies being released this week, and we also look back on last week's predictions. Last time, we were predicting the opening totals for Logan and The Shack. Everybody's really talking about The Shack after last weekend, right, guys?
Oh, yeah, we should do an entire podcast just about The Shack.
Oh, my God. But we'll start with Logan.
No, we should not. No, we should not.
Well, you guys don't want to dedicate an episode to Sam Worthington?
Oh, that's a James Cameron actor we got to pay tribute to.
So Logan, it was the big winner of the weekend, and this was super close between Robin and TK. TK, you said it would make $85 million. Robin, you said it would make $90 million. It made $88.4 million. So Robin takes the point, but it was super close. Meanwhile, back at The Shack, TK, you won this one. You said it would make $10 million. It made $16 million. You had the high bid.
Insider book knowledge.
Yeah, you totally screwed us yet again. And guess what? You're still in the lead. You have 6 points. Robin is in second place with 4. I'm at 2. Running away with it, man. So this weekend is Kong Skull Island, and I just realized I didn't note down the budget of Kong Skull Island, so I want to at least give you that information. It has a budget of $185 million. TK, how much is Kong Skull Island going to make this weekend?
You know what? I think it's going to do really well, even with Logan in theaters. I think it's going to, let's say, 30.
$30 million. Robin, how much do you think it'll make?
I think it'll go higher. I'm going to go with 45.
$45 million, and I'm going to go even higher. I'll say $50 million. We'll see how well it does. Are you guys going to see it? Are you interested in this?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I will definitely be talking about it by the time we do our next podcast.
TK, do you have any interest in Kong Skull Island?
I'm going to try to watch it, but I'm not going to rush.
It's got Tom Hiddleston and John C. Reilly.
Yeah, it does. And Sammy Jackson and
Brie Larson,
John Goodman.
And John Goodman, yeah. Anyway, And Shea Whigham. I'm really curious. It could be terrible. All right, guys, so now it's time for the dumb joke of the week, and I'm going to tee you up for this one. I'm going to see if you can get the punchline right when I'm ready for it to happen, okay? So pay attention. George Clooney, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Matthew McConaughey are hanging out, and they decide that they should all make a movie together. George Clooney says, "I'll direct." DiCaprio says, "I'll star." And McConaughey says,
All right. Okay, you know what, Gil? Kudos to you.
Yeah. That was a good one.
That's a good one. Yeah. Got to give you that one.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at the back row. Contact TK by emailing tk@the-back-row.com. Robin can be reached by emailing robin.warder@the-back-row.com. Be sure to check out The Trail Went Cold at trailwentcold.com, a weekly true crime podcast that Robin hosts and I edit. And, of course, read all of Robin's writing at the-back-row.com, cracked.com, and listverse.com. He is just everywhere online. This man is famous, and we will ride his coattails to stardom. And, of course, you can find everything I do through the-back-row.com, including McGillFoot.com, my video editing portfolio, The Trail Went Cold, and various other projects that I'm involved in. You can reach me by emailing gil@the-back-row.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Shouts from the Back Row is part of the Back Row Podcast Network. Visit the-back-row.com for more. The Shouts from the Back Row theme is composed by Vince Nycrone.